wasn't God showing up in his radiant glory? Well, one of the reasons is if God really unleashed his radiant glory, he'd evaporate the entire universe. Right? That's one. So really, when God comes in darkness, it's probably in part for our protection. Like we couldn't in our souls bear the fully unleashed presence of God. So even in this setting, he has to restrain his glory from coming forth and being visible and being made known. But he still is making himself known as powerful and great. They've never seen these sorts of things in Egypt. You know, the weather was just the weather, right? This is a lot different than a change in the weather. It's a supernatural cloud and thunder and earthquakes or trembling of the mountain at the same time. Moses then goes up the mountain into this alone of all the people. And while he's there, he's told to get Aaron and again warn the people about approaching the mountain, and he goes back down again, right? And then, so next slide. So Exodus 20, more thunder and lightning, and God speaks. He speaks so that all the people can hear. He speaks the Ten Commandments, which takes up verses about 2 to 17. We'll go through those really briefly. And now the people are trembling. They're hearing the voice of God. And they're becoming terrified. Moses is back down on the mountain, and they're asking Moses, like, can we just like back up or have him like just talk to you, because this is overwhelming. They didn't want to even hear the voice of God. It was so overwhelming. And C.S. Lewis says, you know, you might mistake the voice of a man for the voice of God, but you would never mistake the voice of God for the voice of a man. So they're experiencing something like this is a spiritual and audible and visual experience going on for them. So this is overwhelming to them, to the point that like this is unprecedented in their lives, even though they've been delivered through the sea and in many different miraculous ways on the way to this point. This is unprecedented. This is off the scales from anything that they've experienced before. And it's tough on them. It's tough on their spirits, tough on their minds. These are not people who have walked in humility before God, not people who are accustomed to any of this kind of thing. And they just don't know what they're getting into with this God. It's just a lot. And they're asking. But Moses' answer to them when they want some relief and some distance from all this, it's like, God will not break out against you. You're safe. It's like, it's fine. He wants them, God wants them, and Moses wants them to experience this. Moses has been up on the mountain and been in the presence of God while he's been leading Israel a number of times. And he understands that this is actually a good thing to be experiencing. Because there are things in us that need to be shaken by the power and the presence of God. We need to be shaken. Just as the mountain trembles and it's just rocks, we need to tremble in our hearts because of the greatness of God. God is great. He is powerful. And although he restrains his glory and his power almost all of the time, he still has and possesses that glory and that power. And he actually has the right to come and present himself to us in a way that disrupts our hearts. It disrupts our perceptions of him, this disrupts our senses of reality. He has the right to do that, and that's a beneficial thing for us to do. Because we know he's good, it's safe to experience that. And that was Moses' point, is like, I'm not gonna let you have distance or stop this event that's going on. Like, God will protect you. It's okay, it's fine. So when you're in the midst of the storm and the fire like that, and God is moving. He's moving, and he's still good. He's not against you. He's for you in those moments. All right, so amidst these things, God gives the Ten Commandments, which I'll review here in a sec. And he also tells them, as you travel around, wherever you call upon my name, build an altar for me there. And he actually gives specific instructions about that. Among the instructions are, don't use shaped stones. Don't lay hammer and chisel on these stones to make like well-designed, laid-out altars. And then also, don't have stairs that go up to the altar, because basically they didn't want people lifting their legs in their clothes and exposing their nakedness. Even on the off chance that that could happen, even though they wore long clothes, the chance that that could happen was too much. Like, that was not to happen at all. So they actually are supposed to have inclines or ramps. And in Israel today, there are places where some of these altars were made in this fashion are still preserved. And why would he have it so they don't use cut stone on the altar? Well, working with stone takes a long time, especially when you have, you know, Bronze Age tools like this. And if you're spending a lot of time on the altar, you may eventually think that it's about the altar, when it's actually about the God that you're supposed to be worshiping with that altar. So the altar is just a tool, and tools don't have to look great. So putting a lot of work into the stone, like, he doesn't want them to be distracted away from the idea that they're there to be in a relationship with God and conduct business with God at this altar. That's the whole point. There's no other reason for the altar to be there. And it doesn't have to be fancy for those tasks to be completed. So the Ten Commandments are given, and we have those. But and in abbreviated form, they are, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make any idols. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Remember, they weren't supposed to work at all. And even somebody that resided with them, nor their animals, nobody was to work on the Sabbath. So that's every seventh day. And it was Saturday in our calendar. Honor your father and your mother. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And you shall not covet your neighbor's stuff and other possessions that other people have. So I've broken these into kind of four different categories. The first ones really have to do with what is their attitude, or what is the focus of their worship, and it's to be on God and God alone. And so you shall have no other gods before me, you shall not make idols, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, which is different. I think it's more serious than swearing or swearing with the name of God in it. Really, it's saying that you ascribe to God and living in a completely different way. So basically being a hypocrite, you're not to be hypocrites. You're not to take my name upon you as a people and then act like I don't exist and disregard my laws. That's taking the name of the Lord in vain. And we're not to do that either. So that's really about the centrality of God in their worship. And then remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. The Sabbath was meant to be a blessing to them, that they would have a day of rest each day. Now, they didn't have church. They didn't go to church. They didn't even have synagogues at this time. Synagogues came centuries later, many centuries later. So this was just simply a day of rest. And resting, in a context of an agrarian society, these are all farmers and stock keepers and things like that, resting on a day is an expression of trust in God that he will provide despite the fact that you're not doing any work. So that's more of a public or civil or societal obligation and an individual obligation that they should keep the Sabbath. And then honor your father and your mother, don't murder, adultery, steal, or bear false witness. Those are really about having a civil society. And if you grow up honoring your father and mother, you'll be respectful toward other authority as well. Right? And you're not to do these things. So that's about civil society. So it goes from God to sort of the religious expression of trust in God, and then laws about civil society, and then this one, which is the only one that really gets at your mind and your thinking, because coveting is something that you do in your mind. You can sit on the chair and covet something that somebody has. You're not even taking action against another person by coveting, and yet you're not supposed to do that. So we see from time of Abraham, not very much revelation about right and wrong. No, not much revelation about what he was to do and what he was not to do. Here, we're sort of seeing this progressive revelation open up about what God is saying you need to do, you need to not do. And he's even sort of cracking open the idea that your thoughts, even your thoughts, matter. Your thoughts are important. And even those can be out of alignment with his will. Next slide. So the next three chapters, 21 through 23, they kind of have a whole bunch of additional laws, and we'll see a few of them. But they involve rules about servitude. So if you have somebody that's come into your house that's a slave or a servant, there are specific guidelines about how you can and cannot treat them. Personal injuries, it's about accountability for injuring another person, and if you injure them, how you're supposed to make restitution for them. Property rights, let's see what else. A whole bunch of miscellaneous laws about different things. The Sabbath and the land, one of the things, I can't remember, I'd have to look back at these passages, I looked at so many different things, but the Sabbath, they were also supposed to give, as they were supposed to have a rest every 7 days, the land was supposed to have a rest every 7 years. So in the seventh year, they weren't supposed to farm their land at all, farm their land. And God's promise was, do this, I will provide for you in the sixth year enough for you to be able to survive. Like, you'll have plenty of food going into the seventh year when you're not planning on receiving and expecting any food from the land. Do it, and you'll be blessed. And God was ready to follow through on that. They didn't really do it. Various annual feasts that they were to observe. And that's, the annual feasts were to be a party. These were big get-togethers of the whole nation. This was a huge, you know, Lollapalooza Israel type of a thing, you know? And that they were supposed to gather and have feasts and be together and rejoice in the Lord and eat good meals while they're there and just be together worshiping God. Just be together worshiping God. Just have a feast. I want you guys to stop and remember that I'm faithful and have a good time. That was kind of what they were told. And then the conquest of the land, he lays out before them that, like, you're going to go into this land. I'm going to send bees ahead of you. I'm going to do all these things to prepare the way so that when you go in there to take the land, it's not going to be anywhere near as hard as you think it's going to be. So all of this is part of the covenant, right? So we're talking about the Mosaic Covenant, and it's in the next slide and chapter that we see more about this. So Moses wrote down all of the words. So now there's chapters and chapters of things that have been written down for the first time in Israel's history, some written laws that have been given to the nation of Israel. So then there's this passage here, and this is really where the covenant is sort of ratified, or the stamp is put on it. And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Then he got up early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 memorial stones for the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the sons of Israel. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it as the people listened. And they said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient. So Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold, the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all of these words. So this is really where the covenant kind of goes into effect. Countless times, actually, about four or five times, as Moses has gone up and down the mountain, the people have said, we will obey. We will do what you've said for us to do. And here they're saying it again, and this is the context of blood. So if you remember Abraham, there was the covenant ritual where the animals were divided in half, and then in a vision or a dream, God passed between the animals that had been sacrificed. Well, so you think, well, where was the blood in that? Well, Abraham had his hands covered in blood as he sacrificed and divided animals in two to lay on either side as part of this covenant ritual, right? So there's blood in the Abrahamic covenant. There's blood here in this covenant. And so this image here of Moses setting aside some of the blood from these sacrificed animals and sprinkling, I don't know if any of you have been in Catholic Church, but there's this, you know, sprinkling of holy water. There's sprinkling of holy water over the crowd. But so you would take a brush made of a certain plant and basically flick or fling. And so he would walk through the crowd with some of this blood. So he's got a bucket of animal blood from these sacrifices, quite a lot, right? They have to drain all the blood out of the sacrifices. And then, so he's got enough. He's walking around the camp and symbolically sprinkling so everybody gets some through the whole place. So they've agreed to abide by these laws. And this is just, like, as far as laws are going, God's just getting started, because there's 50 different laws here. It gets to a number eventually of like 614 different laws that they have to keep, and they involve all kinds of different things. There's like the ceremonial laws for the priests. There's laws for sacrifices. There are laws for, you just name it. Like, there's laws for just unbelievable numbers of things, like what their hair is supposed to be like, what their clothes are supposed to be like, and what the priest garb is supposed to look like, and when you bring this kind of offering, how you're supposed to do it, and when you bring that kind of offering, and what kind of animals are allowed for this and allowed for that, and what you do with your grain and your first fruits and your firstborn. Like, it goes on and on and on. And there are chapters and chapters through Exodus. There's laws about how the tabernacle is supposed to be constructed, how it's supposed to be carried from place to place, how it's supposed to be set up, who gets to set it up, who gets to be a priest, who doesn't get to be a priest, who gets to go near this and that. It's like there's just immense numbers of laws. And so through Exodus and Leviticus is named after the Levites, who were the servants of the priest, the servants of the tabernacle. So laws in Leviticus. Numbers is more about the travels, but there's additional laws show up in there. And then even in Deuteronomy, when Moses is recapping or recounting the law to the people, Deuteronomy, the word means second giving of the law or second law. So it's like he's going to die soon. Joshua is going to take him into the promised land. At that point, Moses is about 120 years old. So he's giving again. He's reminding, like, you're going to go into this land. Remember what I said. And even in there, there's new laws that we hadn't even heard of before. So the law gets huge, like an amazing number of laws. Let me catch up to myself here. But of these laws in Deuteronomy, it sounds very onerous, but listen to what Moses at age 120 says about the law. See, I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you are to do these things in the land where you're entering to take possession of it. So keep and do it, and do them, for that is your wisdom and your understanding in the light of the peoples who will hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God whenever we call on him? Or what great nation is there that has statutes and judgments as righteous as this whole law which I'm setting before you today? So if you think about this, and you think back to Abraham and the Abrahamic covenant, all the nations of the world were to be blessed through Abraham. Well, now we have the whole nation of Israel who came from Abram. And this body of laws, which was a just set of laws, it gave women more rights, maybe not as many as they really should have had yet, but women were treated horrifically in times prior to this and in cultures other than this. So they had more rights, more standing, more obligations of people to protect and treat women well, also servants, and all kinds of things. This was a just set of laws. People lived however they wanted to, and it was just some ruler would kind of make up out of his head in all the nations surrounding. They would just make up out of their head what was right and wrong. There was injustice. You couldn't get a fair judge. Like, there were no proscriptions against, you know, taking bribes in these other countries. So all these things are dealt with. So this is a body of good laws that were meant to be a testimony of the presence of God and his involvement with this nation. So this is part of God's fulfillment of his promise to Abram that he would be a light to the Gentiles. Right? This body of laws was far, far more advanced and developed, showed a far greater level of moral development than Hammurabi's code and the different great legal systems that were kind of around the region. As good as they got, this was far better, right? Even with its shortcomings, this gave people a lot more rights. And specifically in there, there are a lot of requirements that you do not oppress the poor. You do not oppress the widows and the children. You do not oppress the poor. You don't take bribes to corrupt their cases before them so that you can oppress them. Like, those things had never been written before. So this is very much something to equalize society and keep people in a track where, you know, there's not people just using leverage to get on top of each other, right, and to make advance over each other. So it really was a very just body of laws. But it was demanding. Skip a slide in the next one. There you go. Next one. So here are some of the laws. These are good laws. You shall not oppress a stranger nor torment him, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not oppress any widow or orphan. If you oppress him at all, and if he does cry out to me, I will assuredly hear his cry. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. You shall not give a false report. Do not join your hand with a wicked person to be a malicious witness. In other words, to just swindle somebody out of something. If you encounter your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you must return it to him. Your enemy. You encounter your enemy's animal, livestock, you have to give it back, even if he's your enemy. You shall not pervert the justice due to your needy brother in his dispute. These are good, just laws. Some of the laws are also demanding. The next slide. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male slave or his female slave or his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. So, like, getting your thoughts in line around this stuff, and like, that would be a very tough one to obey. That's demanding. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. For 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male slave or your female slave, or your cattle, or your resident who stays with you. You shall not hold back the offering from your entire harvest and your wine. So they were to give a tithe of that. They're also to give a first fruits offering when they first began to see some of the produce come, give a first fruits offering. And in addition to that, the firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. They were to be dedicated to the Lord, for service to the Lord, dedicated to the Lord. You shall do the same with your oxen and with your sheep. So these are demanding laws. So it's a rigorous code. It's very demanding. It's not easy to actually to live up to this. But they're good laws, and they're meant to be a testimony. So let's just talk about the testimony. I need to get my water back here. I'm drying up. It's going to be bad in a sec if I don't. There we go. So I don't have any more slides. We're just going to talk for the rest of the time here. But the Sabbath, did they keep the Sabbath? No, they didn't keep the Sabbath. When Jesus comes, you see the Jews being fanatical about keeping the Sabbath. They were not fanatical about keeping the Sabbath. They didn't keep it at all. They just ignored it. As soon as they got in the land, almost all this stuff just went out the window. The Sabbath for the land every 7 years, did they keep that? No, in actually 490 years, they didn't keep it once. Not one time did they keep the Sabbath of the land. And so in 490 years, that's 70 Sabbaths for the land that they should have observed. Over a period of 490 years, every 7 years, they should have kept 70 Sabbaths. In Jeremiah, it's very specific that when they were deported to Babylon, the period of their deportation was going to be 70 years, and it's specifically said so that the land can have its rest. So the land can have its rest. It's not just a random number, 70 years, like I'm going to haul you off for 70 years because that's a few generations and you'll learn your lesson. It's because, by gosh, God was going to get his due for that land. And so the land was given its rest for 70 years. It was not tilled. It was basically this empty country. Did they celebrate the Passover? A few times. In Hezekiah's day, which we mentioned last week, they celebrated the Passover. They didn't do it annually very many times at all. Did they celebrate the year of Jubilee? Every 50th year was to be a year of Jubilee. And that was on top of the Sabbath rest for the land that was going to occur on the 49th year because of divisible by seven. The 50th year was also to be the same, and anybody who was an indentured servant or slave in your household was to be set free at that time. So you couldn't have slaves that you had before the Jubilee and then still have them afterwards. So it was supposed to be a year where all property boundaries were reset and families got to go to their inherited lands and return, and they never observed that either. Never once. Did they worship God only? No, they set up altars, they did all kinds of different practices from the people around them, they adopted other gods, they ignored God, they disobeyed his commandments with regard to this time and time and time again, over and over again. And judgment came because God's not going to protect that. He's not, like, if you want to be like them, guess what? You get to be invaded by other countries just like they get to be invaded by other countries. You want to be like them? Here's what it's like to be like them. Worship other gods? Okay, I'll just, like, stand up. I'll be courteous. You can do that. He's courteous. We'll let you make your decisions. But with those decisions will become God's presence is not there. His protection is not there. He's not obligated to keep protecting you while you're completely disregarding and going in the opposite direction. And in the spiritual world, we now know, embracing demonic forms of worship, embracing demonism, like you're welcoming trouble if you do that. Did they remain a moral people? No, they didn't remain a moral people. They weren't supposed to intermarry with the people and the cultures around them. They did that. They weren't supposed to this and that and that and the other thing, you know. So you name it, immoral practices, they were doing all these, especially as they became more into the idolatrous worship and things like that. So they were engaged in all kinds of immoral practices. Did they oppress the poor? Yes. In fact, in King Uzziah's reign, they were very economically prosperous, but it was a time a lot like this where a few rich people had a massive amount of wealth, and they used it to grind the poor down and make themselves wealthier and wealthier. And the prophet Amos prophesied against them, because it was probably at its worst, that particular aspect. Like, they got that, they understood how economies worked, but they understood far too well how economies worked, and they used that as a lever against the poor to just basically make the people of the nation into chattel that they could just grind for labor and to impoverish with debt. They charged interest, so they didn't do any of these things. So the law was a good law, but it wasn't powerful to the effecting of change in people's hearts because, unlike Abraham, they didn't grasp it with faith. Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. But the Israelites, they never really believed very wholeheartedly or through long periods of their time that God was really worth obeying, that this was really worth doing. So faith, they were very starved for faith during this period of the law. And it was burdensome. It was burdensome, but on the other hand, there are things in there that were meant to be celebrations and bring joy to them and allow them the space to have trust and peaceful times with the Lord and see him provide, like the weekly Sabbath, the annual Sabbath, the year of Jubilee, and the different festivals they were supposed to have. They were meant to be things that refresh them in the idea that God is trustworthy. Refresh them over and over again, weekly, yearly, the feasts, every 7 years, every 50 years. So in every generation, these things are being repeated over and over and over again, that there's the opportunities for rest, opportunities for trusting God and see him come through. So the law was, it was certainly a revelation of God's character, that he's interested in justice. He's also interested in holiness from us. He's interested in his holiness being expressed to us. He's interested in his holiness and his righteousness and his goodness being expressed to the nations around. But the law was not powerful in the sense that it brought transformation to people's hearts. It didn't bring transformations to people's hearts. They were to observe by being obedient and then see what God was like. But it didn't have the power like we have through the Holy Spirit to have transformed lives. So there was a shortcoming in the law, which we'll talk about in a couple of weeks. We'll talk about as we sort of tie all these threads of these different covenants together. So, like I said a second ago, during Jesus' time, the Jews were really fanatical about keeping the Sabbath. They're fanatical about that and about all of these different laws. So the Pharisees, they kept like every single thing. Like the clothes were right, like the temple practices were mostly right. Lots of these things, they were trying to do it right. And how did they get from the point way back when they were being deported for not following these laws? Well, this is kind of the history. They went into deportation, they came back out, the temple got rebuilt, the walls around Jerusalem got rebuilt, they got reestablished as a nation in their land. This was in the 400s BC. And then almost immediately they began to fall into idolatry. But through the work of a couple different prophets, they kind of corrected course. And one of the things that they did was they developed, after 100 or so years, they developed the synagogue system. So lots of the principal towns in any given area would have a synagogue. And synagogue wasn't church. Synagogue was for education. So this is where children would go, adults would go, the word of God was read, the laws were explained, discussions about what the law meant were had in these places. And so they're basically a public education system. And you had to belong to the synagogue. Like if you got kicked out, you might as well just move to a different country because your life was dirt in that country by being kicked out of the synagogue. So they finally got serious about the law. So if you think about like why didn't they have that level of seriousness? Like during Moses' time, they were very serious about the law while they were wandering through the wilderness. There were times when they grossly broke the law, but for the most part, they were observing it because Moses was making them observe the day, the weekly Sabbaths and the festivals and stuff. All of that was observed consistently while Moses was leading them. But when they got into the land and Joshua took over, he was a good military leader, but he just didn't really pay attention to that. Like, Joshua is somewhat impressive, but I'm not actually that impressed with Joshua. Because immediately after Joshua and Caleb and the generation that had taken the land passed away, another generation rose up who didn't know the Lord. They didn't know the Lord? They didn't know the Lord? How could they not know the Lord? They're the nation of Israel. They had Joshua and Caleb and that whole generation that had taken the land. No, they didn't know the Lord at all. So they hadn't done anything in the way of public education. And so they finally corrected that by getting the synagogue thing, but they'd kind of forgotten by Jesus' time that really it's about your heart as well. Remember that thing about coveting? How even your thought sins? That was pretty well disregarded. So I'm stopping here because I'm setting us up for, in a couple of weeks, understanding how this covenant, the Mosaic covenant, was fulfilled in Jesus Christ. We'll talk about that. But one thing I want to leave you with is that these laws, the Mosaic covenant, these were the laws given to a specific nation in a specific time. This was not actually for all mankind. And it's not actually for you. Like, these are the laws that for the nation of Israel. I'm not an Israelite. You're not Israelites. We have some connection with them through the things that happened with Jesus, but these are not laws for us. So actually, if you want to make a case, even say for tithing in your giving, you can't really go to the law. There are principles in there about giving to God, but to say that you have to give 10%, which is a thing in the law, and say that to Christians now, like, no, that was a law for a specific nation that we're not part of. I don't think anybody in here is an Israelite, a Jewish person. I don't think so. But those laws were for a specific nation at a specific time, and that becomes very important when we have the next conversation in 2 weeks about what happens with these different covenants, what happens with the law, with Jesus, right? This was a body of laws for a nation that lived in a place in a certain land, a certain people. Different nations have different laws. We have a set of laws in our country. They govern all kinds of things, probably too many things. Other nations have their laws. You go to another country, it's like, that's illegal here? Yeah, that's illegal here. That's crazy. Well, it's our law. It's our law. It's not your law. You're here, you got to obey it because you're here. But so the laws of Israel, it was a law applying to that people. And it had a purpose. It had a couple purposes. For one thing, God wanted to reveal himself so that he's understood and what's on his mind. Like, he cares about oppressed people. He cares about people not being oppressed and other people not being oppressors. He cares about these issues of justice. They're written in the laws to a more advanced level than they had ever been written before. They were also to train people that, like, this law is very demanding, and even at my best, I'm inadequate to keep it. And we'll see the implication of that in a couple of weeks. So it was meant to set context for what Jesus was going to do. That was a huge part of the law, and also make the people a righteous people who had a testimony of God's greatness because of their obedience to these good laws. So that's the Mosaic Covenant and some of the weight of it and some of the importance of it and some of the interesting aspects of it. So, Father, we thank you for your word that this law is preserved for us, the Mosaic.